whole Torah view and understanding of the Bible and of God's work and of God's relationship to man. And the Jerusalem Talmud cites Zephaniah, I don't know how you pronounce, I'm not used to the English pronunciation, Zephaniah, but the Zephaniah 3:9, where the prophet states, "For then I will turn to the peoples a pure language, to call upon them all in the name of God, and to serve Him together." So it's interesting, but just Zephaniah 8:3-8, right in the previous verse, it says, "Therefore wait for me, says the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey. For my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them my indignation, my wrath, all my fierce anger. For all the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy." And then the very next verse it says that I will call to the nations in a clear language. And here's where the rabbis of the Talmud say that this is a prophecy which teaches us that all the nations will accept the seven laws of Noah. But yet in the previous verse, it sounds as if God will destroy the nations. But I believe the answer is self-explanatory. That the important thing is the clear language, which means, clear language doesn't mean the words and the verses. It means the understanding. And it means that at the time when we're approaching the redemption, that what's going to happen is that there will be a clear language, an understanding of Torah will come about. And that clear language will attract the nations. But there will be, of course, some nations that refuse to understand, refuse to listen to the clear language. They will suffer God's indignation. But those who will listen to the clear language and the truth of Torah, those nations will embrace and serve God together as one people. So I just felt that really is the verse that typifies the whole Bnei Noach movement, which is an unbelievable return to the understanding and to the approach of Torah, which means to know basically that the Torah is something that is very deep and something that must be studied carefully. If there's one premise, I would say that the followers of Torah, the rabbinical scholars, have tried to make clear to us, that is that the Torah is intellectually challenging on the highest level. And it is just as intellectually challenging as the most scientific discipline. And it's a work which, although a person may be able to read it in a casual way, they really cannot understand it unless they delve into it clearly with their minds and with their intellect. I would like to today take as an example the chapter in Genesis, chapter 16, which deals with a story, an interesting story. I base it on, before I would introduce this, with two statements of the rabbis. One statement of the rabbis is that the entire Torah is a polemic against idolatry. Okay? And that statement carries amazing depth because it means to say that the Torah, in all its commandments, is an attempt to uproot from our nature, from man's nature, his idolatrous tendencies. And this is the work of the entire Torah. It's amazing. I know that most people here don't have the opportunity, but when you study halacha and you see some of the higher formulations Talmudic halacha, when you see how it's formulated, you see how true this is, how many times, even in the rigid halachic formula, you're cutting across into the sphere where it teaches man to abandon his idolatrous tendencies. That is the entire Torah. This is a statement of the rabbis, and I think the more one studies Torah, the more one sees how true this is. The second statement of the rabbis, which I will use again as an introduction, is that there is not a single chapter in the Torah in which does not contain the resurrection of the dead. It means every chapter in the Torah contains the resurrection of the dead. Now, this does not mean, the rabbis didn't mean it literally. Resurrection of the dead is a specific event. But they use the resurrection of the dead as a mashal, as a parable of a powerful idea, which means there isn't a single chapter in the Torah that if you do not go into it in depth, you will not find the most powerful ideas. In other words, if you go into the Torah in depth, you will always emerge in any chapter with very profound ideas. Now, there's one thing I will mention, and that is that the problem with the Torah is that the Torah is often counterintuitive. Okay? Now, counterintuitive means it goes against our emotional attitude. Now, that's something that cannot be helped, because in order for a person to be educated, he has to abandon the outlook and the attitude that he has now, and he has to be introduced to a deeper way of thinking, which means there's going to be something that goes against what he feels is correct. That's true not only in Torah, it's true in every science. I mean, to say that this table is really not solid, but it contains more space actually than matter, and things are revolving around in it in microscopic subatomic particles at infinitesimal speeds, is something which is against our intuition. But knowledge teaches us that this is so. The same is true in mathematics, and the same is true in any field. Any field of study, a person will find that things are going to be very different after they study than they thought it was at first. And the same thing is true with Torah. Of course, with religion, it's more difficult because people cherish their religious beliefs, and it's very difficult, even when their mind tells them that these beliefs are false, to abandon them. And that's really the process that Torah takes one through. As an example, I would like to, this morning, take the chapter 16 in Genesis. There is a method that the Torah uses. God, in writing his work, used a very specific method, because the Bible is something, as you know, that anyone can read. And yet, the greatest genius can spend their lifetime in understanding the depths of the Torah. So how could the same book be read casually, superficially, and also be read in depth? And one of the methods, I mean, that's basically what the Talmud has, the 13 methods, but I don't want to get into the technical structure of the various methods. I just want to discuss a very basic method that we find in the Bible. I would call it crypticism. In other words, the Torah is intentionally cryptic. And if you take a look carefully, you'll see that when you look a little deeper, that's always a sign. You can casually glance over it, but there's something disturbing. When you look into it deeper, you see there is a more profound idea. I would like to take the story today of Abraham and Sarah and Hagar, the maidservant, Hagar. And over here we find something that's, again, you find that crypticism in the Bible. If you take a look at Genesis 16, we find that God had already predicted to Abraham that he will have offspring, and his offspring will be it will be very plentiful. But then his wife, Sarah, was childless. So Sarah said to Abraham, she said, take my maidservant, Hagar, and live with her, and from her you will be able to produce progeny. Because we know that it's God's will that you should have children. So then what happened was that the Bible tells us a story that this is in 16 verse 4. And he went into Hagar and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was despised in her eyes. Okay. Then the Torah says, and Sarai said to Avram, Actually, I'll translate a little differently in the translation. My anger is upon you. She complained to Abraham. She said the following. I have given my maid into thy bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. Let the Lord judge between you and me. Okay? This was the statement of Sarai. And then we find that Abraham reacted in a strange way. Abraham said to her, he said to Sarai, here is your maidservant in your hands. Do to her whatever is good in your eyes. And the Torah says, and Sarai treated her harshly, tormented her, literally. And she ran away from Sarai. Okay? Let's stop. We'll continue with the storyline in a little while, but let's just stop at this point. So we find that Sarai gives Hagar, to Abraham to conceive, and then she gets very angry at Abraham, and she says to Abraham, I gave you my maidservant, and she felt superior to me. Let God judge between you and between me. Now, the question, of course, is, the argument doesn't sound right. This would be a good argument for Sarah to use against Hagar. That would be a perfect argument. But against Abraham, it doesn't make any sense. Because what she's saying to Abraham is, I gave you my maidservant. So, and what happened? And she thought that she looked at me in a despised way. She looked down upon me. Let God judge between you and me. It's not his fault. She was the one that gave him the maidservant. So the argument is actually going against her objective. In other words, it doesn't make any sense for her to blame Abraham. She's the one that did it in the first place. So why is it Abraham's fault? Does not make any sense. This is what I was referring to before, a kind of crypticism. That when you take a look at the dialogue here, it just doesn't seem to make any sense. Of course, again, we'd like to understand Abraham's response. What was his response? He said, okay, you're unhappy with the situation. You do to Hagar as is fit in your eyes. And then the great Sarah tormented her, and she ran away and escaped into the desert. Doesn't sound like something which is proper. After all, we're talking about Abraham and Sarah, who are the greatest people. They are close to God, prophets, both of them. And it doesn't seem proper that she should act this way. A great person wouldn't act this way. A common person wouldn't act this way. Why did she do that? And what did she have in mind? All right, let's deal with these two questions. I think if we look a little deeper into the verse, the answer is really not too far from the text itself. You see, we have to understand the backdrop here. Here we have Abraham, who is the philosopher of Torah, the philosopher of Judaism. And he comes along with a new religion. And he speaks to the world against idolatry, but not just against idolatry itself, against idolatrous thinking. And his house becomes a center. And people come to this house. They come to study, to learn, to gain ideas, to gain insight on how relating to how man is supposed to properly relate to God. What is the true religion? Now here, what Sarah was saying was something extremely important. She said that Hagar is now in your very household. She is pronouncing, she is promulgating a false philosophy. A philosophy which is against your teachings. What is this philosophy? You see, what happened to Hagar was that she knew that her mistress Sarah, was not able to conceive a child. So then what happened was that she lived with Abraham. And she was successful. She conceived the child. What did Hagar say at that moment? She said, look, Look at this. Here, this great Sarah wasn't worthy of having a child, and she's living with Abraham for many, many years, and I instantaneously became pregnant with a child. God is with me. She had that feeling. God is with me. Look how things happened. I am the chosen one. I am the superior one. That was the emotion that grabbed her. Okay? Now we understand what Sarah said. Sarah said to Abraham, it wasn't really a personal vendetta. What she said to Abraham is, something very wrong is going on here. What is your belief, Abraham? Do you believe that if a person is successful, that this indicates that they are righteous? Or if a person, heaven forbid, is suffering, does this indicate that they are wicked? Is that your philosophy? Didn't you teach us just the opposite? That the Torah maintains you cannot assess and you cannot evaluate the worth of the human being by the events that befall them in their life. That's God's business. We can't make such evaluations. How do we evaluate a person? How did you, Abraham, teach us the proper way to evaluate a person? Not through superstition, not through saying, look what happened. This person did something. He's with God. He was successful. That's idolatrous kind of thinking. You took us away from that kind of thinking. You taught us a deeper understanding. You taught us there's another way to tell. There is a true way to tell whether a person is with God. And that's not by the events that befall them in their lifetime. You know, the Puritans used to believe if a person's wealthy, that means he's with God. So if a person is poor, that means that he's not with God. This is a primitive belief. This was the belief of Hagar. That's precisely what she said. Sarah's living with Abraham all these years and she didn't deserve to conceive a child, and I came in there and right away I conceived the child. I must be superior to her. All the events seem to be lining up that God is saying, I'm the one, you see. That is probably the most tempting the most tempting emotion for a person to cater to. But Sarah was precisely attacking that philosophy and that way of life. That's what she said to Abraham. She said, you taught us to abandon that. That's primitivism. That's not Torah. We don't know why people live through different events in their lifetime. Only God knows that. We don't judge people by events. But we do have a way to judge people. There is a way. What is it? Righteous deeds. That's the way to judge a person. When we see a person does something which is righteous, acts righteously, then we respect that person. And then we say, such a person is a person that is with God. We determine whether a person is with God, not based upon events, mystical happenings, but we determine that a person is with God based upon their deeds, their actions. Now let's take a look again at the verse. And you will see clearly how the text comes to life and explains this philosophy. In verse 5, it says, and Sarai said to Abraham, my anger is upon you. I gave my maidservant in your bosom, and she saw that she was pregnant, and I became light, I became low in her eyes. Let God judge between me and you. What was her complaint? Her complaint was the following. She said, here, this Hagar, what did I do? I did the most difficult thing that any woman could do. And that is to give the man that she loves to someone else. What is more difficult for a woman? There is nothing more difficult for a woman to do in her life. And I was able to overcome my emotions, and I did that. I did a righteous deed. And what happened? She saw she became pregnant. And she said immediately, oh, the events of God are in my favor. I'm superior. Is this justice? Is this the kind of teaching that you have been teaching us? God should judge between me and you. When she said God should judge between me and you, what she meant was that this is not just a personal thing. This, she invoked God's judgment because she was saying, You, Abraham, are responsible because you've allowed that teaching to be promulgated in your household, which is supposed to be the household that represents the true teaching of God. You allowed this to go on. You didn't object. So you are distorting. You are responsible. You are committing the worst crime, which is to allow false ideas to be expressed in your house. What could be worse than that? That's why she said, God should judge between me and you. She meant, now we have to invoke God's judgment because you are doing something which is not righteous. On the contrary, I did the most righteous deed. Hagar acted in an idolatrous way of thinking, and you sat by and condoned it. That's why Abraham, when he heard that, he said to her, he said, I see you have the insight. In this case, I didn't. So he said, I allow you to make the judgment in this case. How can we correct the situation? So then the Torah says to us, Torah teaches us, that Sarah tormented her, and she ran away. What was this tormenting? So the rabbis explain that she treated her like a maidservant. Okay? It wasn't physical tormenting. It was emotional. That's the worst kind of tormenting. She reduced her stature, and she treated her as a maidservant. Now, there is an argument among the rabbis, and I always say that without the rabbis, I could not understand the Bible. I mean, the oral law really is like light on the Bible, gives you insight into the verses. And I've hardly ever come up with anything where I didn't have to make recourse to the words of the rabbis. The rabbis over here in the Talmud seem to say that Sarah was right. That she did the right thing here, and she did the right thing later when she chased away Ishmael. Nachmanides, however, who is a very respectable scholar, says that our mother Sarah sinned in this case. And it was wrong for her to do that. What I want to say is that perhaps they aren't at odds. In other words, whether she was wrong or not is a good question. But you know, in Torah, we're not that concerned about being right or wrong. We're more concerned about having the right approach. And what we have to understand, even if we should accept Nachmanides that ultimately was the wrong thing to do, what we have to understand is, how could Sarah do this, the great Sarah? After all, in Abraham, Abraham is known as the pillar of kindness. How could he allow this to take place? I believe based upon our understanding, the way we understood the dialogue up to this point, we could now understand what Sarah's intention was. Her intention was the fact that this false philosophy was being expressed by Hagar. She felt there's only one way to undo this, and that is to put Hagar back in her place as a maidservant. Because that would show that she is not the selected one of God. And that whole approach is false. That was her method of undoing the harmful idea that Hagar had espoused. In other words, Sarah wasn't simply acting on a personal level here, because we're dealing with a great human being. But she was trying to correct the error. And Abraham himself told her, he said, look, I didn't notice, you're right. I'm busy, I was involved in helping people, I was involved in thinking in Torah, I was involved in relating to God, and I didn't notice this. You noticed it. You have superior knowledge. You determine what to do. So all she did was she reduced her stature. Because when a person is in a reduced state, reduced stature, reduced self-esteem, then they can't walk around thinking that they are the special one of God. And through that, Sarah really attempted to remove this kind of a philosophy from Hagar. Okay? Whether she acted too stringently, I leave that open. Nachmanides feels that it was too stringent. There are statements in the Talmud that would seem to indicate that it was correct. But that's not the important thing. The important thing for us to understand is the basic motivation of Sarah. And that she was not acting in a wicked way. What she was trying to do was to correct the situation. And again, I mean, this situation is one which has very practical value for us today. That's why the rabbis say there's always the resurrection of the dead. It means it's something which is important. It's a powerful idea. How many times in life do we feel, well, look, I went and I did this. I tried. Hey, God is with us. We're doing the right thing, you see. How many religions try to appeal to us by saying, look, we went, we did this, God was with us. We ordinarily, it took us 5 days, it took us a day, it took us an hour. Miracles are happening all over. God is with us. This kind of philosophy, Abraham and Sarah taught us, this kind of thinking is basically of an idolatrous nature. That is judging things by events. Saying that if the event was successful, the person behind the event is righteous. This is false. What Torah teaches us is, look at the deed itself. Look at the action. Is it righteous? Is it not? Look at the cause. Is the cause righteous or is it not? If it's intrinsically not righteous, I don't care how many events occur that seem to say that they're going to be successful, doesn't mean anything. Zero. Wipe it out. That's an idolatrous type of thinking. That's what the Puritans used to think. This is the lesson that the Torah teaches us right here in these verses, an extremely important one. When I thought about this, there was another part of Genesis that came to my mind. Maybe someone here is thinking about it also. There is, in Genesis 26, 28, there is the story of Avimelech. And Avimelech, the king, Abimelech, as you know, he chased away Isaac. First he had an encounter with him, as you recall, and they chased him away. But then later, Isaac was successful. And upon being successful, Abimelech approaches, takes a group of his friends, and he goes back to Isaac, and he wants to make peace with him. And what does he say? He says to Isaac, he says, 26:28, and they said, it means Avimelech and his entourage, said, we saw that God is with you. And we said, let there be a vow between us, and let's have a covenant between us. Okay? Now this, of course, again, strikes you immediately. What do you mean, we saw that God was with you? Strange kind of a thing. We saw that God was with you. Why? How? Well, the answer seems obvious, because in the previous verses it says that Isaac was successful. What kind of a philosophy is that? That's precisely the philosophy that Abraham and that Sarah taught that one should eradicate. That's the false philosophy. And yet the Torah says that Avimelech is saying exactly that. Okay? Of course, it's not really a difficulty, because one could say that Avimelech was not the individual, the person, who was a paradigm of Torah. He was not a Torah individual. So he was operating on a primitive level. And it was really wrong. Okay? He was wrong. But the Torah records it because that's what happened. Okay? You could interpret it that way, and that would remove the difficulty and the contradiction. But again, I always am very cautious, and I like to look at the words of the rabbis. And when I understand what they're saying, and I look back at the verses, I see how correct they are. They have a remarkable sensitivity for the text. And here's an instance. The rabbis of the Talmud say that when Avimelech said, we saw that God is with you, in Hebrew, you can't get this in the translation, it's impossible to translate it, but in the Hebrew, if I would translate it literally, what it says is like this. It doesn't say, we saw that God is with you. It says, this is literally what it says. Seeing, we saw that God is with you. You have the infinitive there. Ro'o, ro'inu. Seeing, we saw. There's an extra word there that is completely unnecessary. And the rabbis of the Talmud say, why does it say twice seeing in Hebrew? Because Avimelech really said, we saw twice. We saw the deeds of your father Abraham, and now we see your deeds. In other words, the rabbis of the Talmud are telling us that in this verse, when Avimelech said, we saw that God is with you, what was he saying really? It wasn't the success. Yeah, the success may have attracted him. He saw, hey, this man is so successful. Well, what's going on here? He looked into it. But when he looked into it, he came to another conclusion. It wasn't the success that impressed him. It was the deeds. He said, seeing we saw, we looked into this. We actually investigated this. And we saw your father's deeds. Your deeds are on a very high level. And that's why we said that God is with you. So you see, the rabbis interpreted this verse to be precisely in line with the whole philosophy that took place before in the dialogue between Abraham and Sarah with regard to Hagar. Okay? And then when I saw that, I realized what they were doing, and I saw they were right. Because if you have a sensitivity for the text, you seem to feel, you seem to sense that the Torah is endorsing the statement of Avimelech. The Torah is endorsing it. Because the Torah doesn't usually record things unless they have a deep meaning. So, if a higher sensitivity to the text, in my opinion, would warrant precisely what the rabbis are saying, namely, that Avimelech was on target. Which shows you something else. That Abraham was so influential because one of his friends was Avimelech, the father of this Avimelech. And when he had his party, he had Onir, Eshkol, Mamre, and Avimelech, all at the party when Isaac was 2 years old, when he weaned Isaac. So Abraham was a man, as you know, who dealt with all these great people. He was friendly with them all. And to party with Abraham means to learn ideas. Abraham's parties were discussions and concepts and philosophy. And that's why Avimelech really was on the level, where he was impressed by Isaac's unbelievable success, but that wasn't really what moved him. What moved him was when he looked into his deeds. He said, this man must be doing something different. And then he said, he is indeed righteous, and he's following his father's righteousness as well. That's why he said, let there be a covenant between us. Okay. So the Torah over here is consistent. Now, what I would like to do is to show you that this philosophy, which is extremely important, because as I said before, religious groups will always try to dupe you and to attract you with this kind of thinking. Ah, we're with God, look what happened, we went here, we were successful. We know that those methods are used purely, completely by charlatans. And we must always be wary and be careful never to be impressed by anything like that. But I'd like to show you that there is something very similar, and it's equally as important. And it's in the same line. But it requires extremely important because it gives us a depth of understanding in Torah in general. And that is an incident that took place in Numbers 16. Okay? In Numbers 16, you have the famous story of Korach. That is the first rebellion against Torah. That's what Korach is. It is the first rebellion against Torah, and in my opinion, it is also the last rebellion. Because in every rebellion are the same ideas that you find in Korach. It's the prototype of rebellion. That's why the Torah records it. Not just an isolated case. Now it's interesting. What did Korach do? Korach rebelled with 250 men. He came before Moses and Aaron and he rebelled against them. Okay? What did he say? What was his problem? So the Torah text is very clear. It says, and they arose before Moses, and men from the children of Israel, numbering 250, they were the heads of the congregation, men of stature, men of name, and they gathered together against Moses and Aaron, and they said to them, it is too much for you. In other words, why are you taking so much for yourselves? Because the entire congregation is holy and God dwells amongst them. And why do you raise yourself up high upon the congregation of God? Okay? So Korach's complaint to Moses was, you, Moses and Aaron, are taking all the honors and all the glory. Moses is the leader. He's the head. Aaron is the high priest. And Aaron's offspring are going to be the priests, the priestly caste. This is arrogance. Okay? The entire congregation is holy. You're not any different than anybody else. Isn't every Jew holy? Who are you to make yourself superior? That was Korach's complaint. Very good complaint. I mean, he knew what to say. Interesting, the rabbis tell us a funny story. The rabbis tell us, this is Midrash, but I want to show you that Midrash, when you understand it, fits right into the verses. It's not extraneous. If Midrash is extraneous, seems superadded, it means you don't understand the Midrash. The Midrash says that Korach came before Moses with tzitzit. Okay? And he asked Moses a question. He said, you know that every four-cornered garment, you must put the tzitzit on each corner. And on the tzitzit, you have the blue thread. Okay? The blue is there because the blue, as you know, the Midrash says, reminds one of the vastness of the ocean and then of the space and the universe and infinity and God. Okay? It's a trip towards the idea of God. So Korach asked Moses, he said, well, let's say the four-cornered garment itself is completely blue, dyed blue. So what would I need the tzitzit for? Doesn't make any sense. I see the blue right away. Okay? So what would you say, Moses? So Moses said, no, you have to put the tzitzit on this four-cornered garment. So they all began to laugh. They said, this is ridiculous. This doesn't make any sense. They said, let me ask you another question. You know you have to put a mezuzah on the doorpost. Why? To remind you of your purpose in life. God, the oneness of God, study of Torah, all the important ideas that are contained, the most important ideas that are contained in that chapter. Okay? He says, well, let's say I have a house that's filled with scrolls of Torah. What's holier than that? The whole house is filled with scrolls of Torah. Do I have to put the mezuzah on the doorpost? Moses says, yes, you have to do it. So they all began to laugh. They said, this is nonsense. If the purpose is to remind you of God, we have all these Torahs in the house, more than one little scroll, so what's the purpose of this? This, the rabbis give us, was the backdrop. Now, how does that fit in exactly with what his complaint was? See, I believe the answer is very simple. The answer is that Korach was a very smart man. He knew he's not going to get very far with Moses unless he breaks down the institution of halacha first. Because Moses will say, look, I am the leader, I am the greatest scholar, true, and Aaron, God told me Aaron's supposed to be the priest. This is halacha, you can't argue with that. It's the word of God, it's halacha. Korach knew that he's going to be in trouble when Moses says that. So what Korach did first was, he twisted the philosophy of halacha. What he did was, he said, you can take halacha out of its rigid structure and you could philosophize it. It's nothing more than philosophy. Once you reduce halacha to philosophy, you get a totally different picture. In other words, if you're going to say, well, tzitzit is just there for one purpose, to remind you of the blue. Okay, so my whole garment is blue. What do I need the tzitzit for? Right? He first got the people, he influenced the people to believe that halacha can be philosophized. Once you can philosophize it, then the structure's gone. So then it doesn't make any sense when it says in the Bible, on the four corners of your garment, you should put the tzitzit. I'll say, one second, what's the purpose of that? Oh, I'll do it my way. I have another way to do it. Okay? It's all philosophy. There is no rigid halachic system. There's no real structure here. Now, first he got the people to believe that halacha is just philosophy. Now he went to Moses and Aaron. Now there was nothing that they could answer. What is Moses going to say? That Aaron is, this is halacha, that Aaron is the high priest? What do you mean it's halacha? There's no such thing. Everybody's holy. You're saying that you're more important, you're superior to us. This is what you're saying, and you have no right to say that because we're all holy. We're all at Mount Sinai. Who are you? What is your superiority? So he threw Moses into a different light. What he did was he projected onto Moses an arrogance and made him appear like he's an arrogant person seeking respect for himself and his brother, he and his family. What is the truth? The truth of the matter is, I mean, of course, you know, the event that took place where God intervened and Korach was swallowed up and his entire congregation, which demonstrated one thing, again, an important principle. You cannot philosophize away halacha. Halacha is not subject to philosophy. Let me give you an example. You have, for instance, a Kohen, a priest. You have a Levite, all right? Who is superior? So you'll say, well, the Kohen's superior. He does the work in the temple. The Levite, he just does two things. He sings in the temple, and also he opens and closes the gates. So you'll say, okay, the Levite cannot do what the Kohen can do. So the Kohen's superior. But the halacha states that a Kohen cannot do what the Levite does as well. You see. He is equally responsible to abstain from performing what the Levite does. Why? In the words of the rabbis, what the Torah teaches is each man is on his post, as it says in Numbers. Ish ish alav odoso v'almaso. Each man on to his work and to his assignment. Okay? What does this mean? It means that you cannot philosophize position in Torah. In other words, if one person is a Kohen, it does not mean the Kohen's superior. No, not at all. Just like events in a person's life, you cannot say that because this person was successful and he became wealthy and he has a good family and he's healthy and his family's healthy and they're very happy that they are righteous people. Doesn't mean a thing. And the converse is true also. You can't say because a person is not well, his family is not well, he can't earn a living, that he's evil. This is nonsense. The same thing is true with the halachic positions. The Kohen, and this was what Moses was trying to explain, Kahuna, the institution of being a priest, doesn't mean that he is superior in any way. This is halacha. There is a system that God has given. There must be a system. And if a particular individual is cast into one part of the system, doesn't make him superior to another individual. That's halacha. Halacha cannot be philosophized and does not indicate superiority in man. This is an important concept. Very important concept. It's important because it applies to us here as well. It applies to Bnei Noach. Does it mean that if a person is a Ben Noach, that he is inferior to a Ben Israel, intrinsically inferior? The answer is absolutely not. Absolutely not. This is what David Davis has been saying for years, that each person has their place in life, and each person, ish, as Maimonides states, as the Torah says, each man on his work and on his mission, on his assignment. It does not indicate individual superiority or inferiority. Just like events in life don't indicate superiority and inferiority. The only thing that we use as a barometer of inferiority and superiority is righteous deeds. This is what the Torah teaches us in that dialogue between Abraham and Sarah concerning Hagar. This concept requires a little more elaboration. Because we do say, for instance, that the tribe of Levi, the rabbis say, and it's pretty obvious from the text of the Torah, that the tribe of Levi was superior because they didn't serve the golden calf. And if you read between the lines, it becomes clear that they did have some kind of superiority, and that's why they were given the kahuna. Okay? But I want to explain that. You see, there are two types of situations in life. In our relationship to God. One is what we deserve. Okay, we believe that a righteous person, person that keeps the Torah, deserves a certain good. and that God will not fail to repay him and to give him that good. Okay? But then there's a different system. That's system A, one system. But now there's another system. The other system is that God in his divine wisdom sees fit to create certain institutions. They're necessary. They're necessary in order for Torah to be able to continue to exist and for us to be able to study Torah right here and now, thousands of years after the Torah was given. There are certain institutions that are necessary. These institutions, certain people took. Okay? They took it, and it was given to them because at that time, they were the best ones, the most capable of doing it. But that's not the same thing as saying that the institution defines them as superior. That's a different, it's a subtle concept, but there is a big difference. In other words, if somebody would come here and say, look, I have $1 million to give out to somebody in this room. So you decide who it is. So we have a meeting. Not a very pleasant one, but we'd have a meeting. And finally we'd say, well, this person is the most righteous person. And we concluded, if such a thing were possible, we concluded that, I mean among humans, to do such a thing, say this person deserves it. It wouldn't mean that the $1 million indicates that this person is worth $1 million and the fellow next to him isn't. It doesn't mean that. It means that there is only one gift, and the one that should get it is the one that's most capable. That concept we do find in Torah. You see, the Levites at the time were really, they did have an edge. They did have a superior edge. God wanted to give an institution of priestliness, of kahuna, and of the Levite. And he gave it to that tribe. But it was a gift at the time because it was necessary, and it was given to the one at the time who was the most capable, the best one. It doesn't mean that it indicates an intrinsic superiority. It means that's the way it was. And the same thing is true with B'nai Israel. The Torah had to be given at a certain time. The B'nai Israel were the ones that at that time they were ready to receive it. Okay? Does not indicate superiority. It indicates that God's plan will always take place. When he has a plan, he will give it to the one at the time that is most capable. That's something different than saying intrinsic superiority. Quite different. So we have two types of situations. And that's precisely, if you look carefully now in the verse, again, when one arrives at the correct notions of Torah and you look inside the text, you see how the text starts to light up. It has meaning. Take a look at the story with Korach that we were referring to before. Okay? It says they gathered against Moses and Aaron and they made their complaints, as we mentioned before. And it says Moses heard and he fell on his face. Apparently, he simply couldn't respond. You know why he couldn't respond? Because Korach was lodging against him a complaint that you can't defend. It's indefensible. If someone says you're doing this because you're arrogant, that's it. What are you going to say? You know? He took Moses and he depicted him as everything he did was just for his own glory. It's not true, but how do you defend yourself? Anything you say, no one's going to believe you. So he was just stunned. But then he said to them, he says, he says, the only thing I could tell you is, this demands an experiment. And he told them to take the incense and to bring it before God tomorrow, and you'll see what will happen. Okay. But then, so that was his first response. If once he was put in the light of an arrogant person, can't defend himself, so then he just said, well, the only thing we could do is we see what's going to happen tomorrow. I can't say anything. You've depicted me as an evil person. I can't defend myself. Nothing I could say. But let's see what God does. Okay? That was his only response. But then later he adds something. In verse 9, he says, is it not enough for you? Is it little for you that the God of Israel separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you, to draw you near to him, to serve in the Mishkan, and to stand before the congregation to serve them? What was that second argument that Moses used? The second argument was, you're making a mistake. You think that if a person is a priest, it indicates intrinsic worthiness. It doesn't. A given Israel could be more worthy than a given priest. That's not a measure of a human being. But it is a gift of God, and it was given to people, and at the time, he gave it to the ones that were best capable of doing it. Okay? Because that plan had to be implemented. So he said to them, he says, you're complaining. You should be happy because you've got a gift already. Isn't it enough that God gave you this gift? Now you want uvikashtem gam guna, and you also want the priesthood? You're demanding that gift too? That doesn't make any sense. It's not a matter of intrinsic worthiness. And God has certain plans. And he decides who at the time is best capable of carrying out these plans. Now he gave you part of that gift already, but that's not enough for you? That's what Moses taught. Moses taught the correct ideas concerning the kahuna, concerning the priesthood, and concerning how God dispenses his responsibilities. And the responsibility is given based on the fact that at the time the people who receive it are most capable. But that doesn't indicate intrinsic worthiness. Doesn't mean that a person who is a priest is better than a given Israelite who is not a priest. There's nothing to do with it. And it's a general concept that the Levites were superior, and therefore this gift, which had to be implemented, was given to them. But that's the way God worked. It doesn't indicate intrinsic superiority. That's what Moses said. So Moses said to them, you already received one gift, and now you're greedy, you want the kahuna also? You want the priesthood also? You're misconstruing the whole concept over here. Okay. So this basically, I think this lesson follows through. It has one theme. It starts in Genesis, and it goes through over here, which teaches man an important concept. And that is one of the most basic concepts of Torah. And that is that God judges a person based upon his deeds, his actions, his knowledge, his understanding, his love of Torah, and his love of God. And there is no other indicator. As a matter of fact, you know that we have in Israel an unfortunate institution. It's the institution of mamzer. Maybe many of you are familiar with the term, which means to say that the child of a certain type of illicit relationship cannot marry into the nation of Israel. Okay? That's a tragedy, terrible tragedy. But it is an institution that God gave in the Torah. And apparently God in his divine wisdom felt that this is something which must be done in order to prevent these illicit kind of relationships. But it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate for the individual. And in halacha, halacha is very kind, because in halacha there are many ways. I don't mean we never get around halacha, but halacha is created in a way with built-in methods, because the Torah does not really want to be stringent. It's not the purpose of the Torah is not to be stringent. It's to work within a certain framework of reasoning and thinking. That's the objective. And that's why the halacha is very kind. We say in the prophets, it says, her ways are ways of derecha adarchei noam. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, okay? But that's God's divine wisdom and how he organized. But nevertheless, sometimes that's it. You can't budge. I mean, you can't just manipulate anything. I mean, halacha to a certain point, there's a lot of leeway, and you can work within the system. The system mainly is made to avoid discomfort and difficulties, and to get into a certain intellectual framework where you have the knowledge, but you don't have to suffer the inconvenience. But sometimes there's nothing you can do. Sometimes that's it. Can't do anything. It's halacha, and then we invoke the statement of the prophets, which is there is no ein etzav, ein tvun, and neged Hashem. There is no knowledge, and there is no advice, no counsel against God. Sometimes we say, that's it, we can't. Now you know what the halacha states. The halacha states that a mamzer, a person who is an unfortunate, if he is a great scholar, he gets more respect, you say, than the high priest. Okay? That is the motto of Torah. Because the fact that he is a mamzer, we can't do anything about it, we can't change it. But does this indicate he's an inferior person? On the contrary. Doesn't mean anything. Not an indication whatsoever. And on the contrary, if he could be the greatest scholar in Israel, and he will receive more respect than the high priest himself. Okay? Because a person's worthiness is determined by the internal self, not by any kind of institutions or events. Events or institutions, even if they are halachic institutions, do not indicate personal worthiness. That is the philosophy of Torah. That's what Torah teaches us. That's the philosophy of Abraham.